NBC presents the NBC War Telescope. Each week at this time, the National Broadcasting Company calls in one of its reporters overseas to give you a review of the week of war and an estimate of the week to come. Today, we take you to Paris for the report of Merrill Muller and an interview with a special guest. First, a brief review of the latest news. The Germans have stiffened at the western end of their salient into Belgium, throwing back Allied troops as much as 1,000 yards. But on the northern side of the bulge, troops of the American First Army have pushed ahead on a broad front, meeting lighter enemy resistance. British and American bombers have slammed Nazi targets behind the western front. Moscow reports that the Germans have set fire to sections of Budapest. Tokyo says American B-29s have raided the Jap home island of Kyushu, perhaps including Tokyo, and other B-29s have hit Nanking in China. And now to NBC in Paris.
This is Merrill Muller speaking from Paris.
The whole world marvels today at the epic American defense of the key strategic town of Bastogne in the now famous Rundstedt salient on the Western Front. Reams of details have been written and told of how the bloody bastion held out, how it was supplied, and finally how the encirclement of the 101st American Airborne Division was broken, and that division reinforced for counterattack. But there is another story of Bastogne, one I found when I was up there. That is the story of the men who were there, how they felt, how they lived, how they ate, fought, and died, and what their conditions were like within that cauldron which hurled its defiance at the Nazis with the simple and time-honored American expression of nuts. The National Broadcasting Company has the honor to bring this story of the men of Bastogne in the words of one of them. War Telescope presents the only war correspondent attached to the 101st Airborne Division, the man who stood beside them, taking notes through 10 horrible days, though he knew his proud record of American battle history might never reach the outside world for posterity. Speaking for the men of Bastogne and about them, we present Mr. Fred McKenzie, war correspondent for radio station WBEN and the Buffalo Evening News. Mr. McKenzie.
I think all the soldiers at headquarters of the 101st Airborne Division in besieged Bastogne at times were resigned to the probability that they ultimately would fight the Germans there in the division command post. As Lieutenant Colonel Paul A. Danahy put it, "I'll bet we will shoot Kraus here before this is over." They were prepared for it. The division CP was organized for a last stand defense. Tanks were stationed about the courtyard from time to time in the first days with guns pointed at the gate through which the foe might enter. As it happened, the enemy penetrated the outer ring of defense now and then, but each time the defenders skillfully wiped him out. After 10 days of little sleep, inadequate food, shelling, bombing, and frustration because I had not been able to send a single dispatch about this epic struggle, I personally was resigned to seeing a green-clad horde and tanks overrunning us in the final melee. Only then, I knew, could the Germans crush the fires of courage and resolution that characterized the 101st Airborne Division in fulfilling its mission to hold Bastogne. The greater part of my fanciful anticipation of being overrun was based on the sound knowledge that one division and its few attached units were bound to be crushed by the weight of all or part of 7 enemy divisions, unless we were blessed with miracles. I think we did have miracles.
The miracles of great leadership under Brigadier General Anthony C. McAuliffe, Deputy Commanding General of the Division, and his staff, the miracle of great human courage and resolution, and finally the miracle of sudden change in weather from rain and fog to brilliant sunshine and moonlight. The 101st Airborne Division is accustomed to fighting within an enemy encirclement. Lieutenant Colonel Danahy, whose home is in Buffalo and Minneapolis, a member of the general staff, said, "The situation is normal now, and we can begin to fight the real war." He said it when the Germans moved around to the west of us to complete the encirclement on the third day of the battle. I am not accustomed to being encircled within a 5-mile perimeter of battle, and I was scared. You'd be a fool if you weren't. The real significance of the siege of Bastogne, it seems to me, is that the 101st Airborne Division refused to be abjectly afraid in the face of unknown perils. Everybody but the paratroopers and the medics were heading west, said one soldier whose outfit was disorganized earlier in the sudden German thrust toward Bastogne. Many soldiers of other units welcomed the chance to continue fighting alongside the airborne. Tank men still holding out at isolated roadblocks were overjoyed when the paratroopers and glider soldiers who had ridden into battle in trucks came up as supporting infantry. In a day or two, the whole picture changed from one of doubt and disorder to organized defense and almost superhuman effort. Despite a hell of shelling and bombing day and night, I slept at first in a room in one of the barracks buildings with the division's liaison officers. Frequently, I stood outside and heard enemy shells flying overhead to explode in the city. On the first day, a dud plunged through the roof of the building housing the general's mess, bounced on the floor 3 feet in front of a soldier, through a wall, and came to rest on a windowsill. We accepted it as rather funny. A sense of humor, be it ever so grim, is a big asset at such times. One morning, we discovered a 5-foot shell crater outside the building where we stayed. There was a 1-inch hole through a window of a room adjoining that where I slept with the liaison officers. On the second night, a shell exploded on the roof of one of the barracks buildings. 2 men were killed and 4 wounded. Other soldiers quartered there came tumbling out, covered with plaster dust, laughing like schoolboys fleeing from a snowballing. There is nothing else to do but laugh, and you do laugh involuntarily. You get the shudders later. On the third evening of the siege, I was riding in a cellar crowded with men, there mainly because it was one of the few places where there was light, generated for the CP. There was a heavy explosion, heavier than the many we heard almost continually in those days. In a few minutes, an officer commanding the tank destroyer unit attached to the 101st Airborne came in. "That last one just chewed up your bedroll," he said. I laughed. When I heard men had been killed in the room where I slept, I went up to look. The shell of terrific explosive power and delayed action had wrecked the room. 4 men were killed and another wounded. I didn't laugh then, of course. But when others seemed to be looking at me searchingly to note my reaction, I shrugged and said, "C'est la guerre." You didn't dare, nobody dared, to let others see him flinch. Besides, having escaped that blast, I felt that some special providence was protecting me. The fog through the first 5 days was a phenomenal thing. It came in dense clouds like a sudden burst of white steam drifting over the ground and disappeared as suddenly. First the Germans and then the Americans attacked under its cover of those strangely moving crowds. The battle was a series of individual unit skirmishes for days. Meager supplies of artillery ammunition were used sparingly, but even so, our guns were silent some days and nights until supplies came in by sky train Saturday. Clearing weather brought the much-needed supplies and air support, but it also brought visitations of the Luftwaffe, to turn Christmas Eve into a horrible night for the defenders of Bastogne under a cold, bright moon. In the first raid, the city was lighted by flames, and I went through deserted streets until I reached their source. A direct hit on a hospital aid station had fired the structure, and wounded men died there. Soldiers did their best to extinguish the fire, but it burned a long time. Meanwhile, the shells were being dumped into the city. I crouched against walls and sought out shelter in cellars a dozen times during the 2-mile walk to and from the hospital. You may be sure that by this time I was sorely doubtful that Providence had any intention of sparing me for anything. I felt very useless, the only American civilian there in Bastogne, prevented even from carrying on my wartime pursuit of reporting events that happened in this war. Meanwhile, the enemy was preparing one of his biggest defensive thrusts during the siege. It came at 3 o'clock Christmas morning, beginning with another heavier air raid and a violent shelling of the division CP. When bombs screamed down, there were 2 sentries and this war correspondent crouching in a foxhole, which, fortunately, was a big one. Shells whined and burst. We heard metal tinkling on the paving stones in adjacent barrack buildings. Flares were dropped. Tracer bullets streaked the sky. It was an eerie spectacle, and you almost lost your senses. When the barrage lessened, I found another foxhole. When more bombs screamed down, I did my best to expand my helmet to cover that hole, and I remember thinking or feeling or saying, "Thy will be done, thy will be done." I thought or said it over and over with great rapidity, and I can't tell you for how long. About that time, a shell hit a pole 20 feet away, broke the pole, and splattered against the building standing between me and it. No one was hurt, though the two sentries were 10 feet from that pole. These are the times, I suppose, when they say there is no atheism in foxholes. I wasn't an atheist in the first place. As Colonel Danahy, coming from the Catholic evening Christmas Eve service, said, religion in times like these is a wonderful thing. And another time, First Lieutenant Richard B. Miller of East Aurora, New York, said, fear, God Almighty I fear, but there is that buildup of my religion in the past. It is so important in the training of children. It has come to me what we are fighting for here. I am fighting for freedom in religion, for what we want to do, whatever it may be. Freedom of the spirit. Lieutenant Miller's mother is a Christian Science practitioner. He led a tank destroyer reconnaissance unit. I talked to him on the fourth day of the battle while he still stopped enemy tanks. Men of the tank destroyer and tank units rejoiced in the magnificent courage and intelligence of the airborne soldiers. During the fogs of the first days, the foot soldiers stalked down tanks that the tank destroyer gunners could not see from their greater range. By prearrangement, the infantrymen fired tracer bullets against the tank. When the bullets bounced off the German armor, the tank destroyers drew a bead on their targets and smashed them. The airborne also had a lively admiration for the outfits fighting with them. One of these was an artillery howitzer unit with Negro personnel. I saw Sergeant Tully May of Brooklyn, Corporal William S. Rich, Jr. of Jamaica, New York, and PFC Charles R. Maddox, Jr. of Kansas City, Kansas. Negroes ranging in age from 21 to 30 withstanding a hellish bombardment at their radio communications truck. It made me pretty happy to see these concrete refutations of Hitler's super race nonsense here on the Nazis' own testing ground, the field of battle. I saw little Private Chuck Wong of Visalia, California, sweeping up great piles of plaster and debris after each night of damage in RCP. He, a Chinese boy, was as brave and resolute as any other of this brave, resolute 101st Airborne Division. I have not begun to tell the complete story of the courage and sacrifice of these American soldiers in the defense of Bastogne. I saw wounded men in the division hospital so eager to help the inadequate medical staff that this overworked staff had more unskilled help than it knew what to do with. I couldn't even help there. As a civilian, I feel pretty humble about it all, and I feel heartened, too. I think there is proof enough that the 101st Airborne Division and its attached units were fighting and dying there at Bastogne to save the world from a greater encirclement of doubt and fear. Those things they conquered.
Thank you very much, Mr. McKenzie. War Telescope this afternoon has brought you Mr. Fred McKenzie, war correspondent for WBEN and the Buffalo Evening News. Mr. McKenzie was attached to the 101st American Airborne Division throughout its epic struggle in the Bastogne pocket. Mr. McKenzie has brought you his own personal eyewitness experiences in being with that heroic unit of the United States Army fighting here in the European Theater of Operations under General Dwight D. Eisenhower. This is Merrill Muller returning War Telescope now to the NBC Newsroom in New York.
You have just heard Merrill Muller and his guest Fred McKenzie speaking to you from Paris. In New York, once again, the NBC War Telescope brings you the headline news of the moment. President Roosevelt's State of the Union message has been read to Congress, and here are its main points. The president called for total mobilization of all the human resources of the United States to smash Nazi Germany in 1945 and to speed the defeat of Japan. Once again, Mr. Roosevelt called for unconditional surrender, but this time referred only to the surrender of the armies of our enemies. He renewed his demand for a national military service law during the war and universal military training after it. He also called for the drafting of nurses, an expanded Social Security program, and modification of taxes after victory. During the last quarter hour, NBC has brought you the weekly War Telescope. Listen next week at the same time for the NBC War Telescope. Joel Chesney speaking. This is the National Broadcasting Company.